Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. We have two items on our agenda today. I'm going to start by opening the public hearing on House Bill 3308. I think it's recent enough that we probably don't need to have the summary again. Hopefully people remember the conversation we had on Monday about about cultural competency. One of the main reasons we wanted to carry it over and reopen was to give Representative Gallegos a chance to talk, since we didn't have the pleasure of your company on Monday.
Good morning.
So, Representative Gallegos.
Thank you very much, Joe Guy, for the record, Joe Gallegos, Representative, House District 30. I assume that you had great testimony the other day from folks, and I just want to emphasize my support clearly this notion of cultural competency seems to be very ubiquitous these days. And I'll tell you a funny story, I suppose. I'm actually quoted in the literature as having initiated the concept of cultural competency as based on an article I wrote when I was at the University of Washington in 1982. And I mentioned this to a dean at my university, and he said, "Well, you know, Joe, that's kind of like Al Gore saying he invented the internet."
Which he never did. Which he never did.
Which he never did. So, and you know, my article actually in 1982 was really one of many. It's like many things spontaneously, sort of people get ideas and things sort of rise up. And
priority builds.
But I am very, very proud and to be connected with this notion of cultural competency. I think that, as I said, it's pretty ubiquitous in human services and going into the medical field and healthcare. It's really a very simple notion, just the idea that you incorporate culture into the dynamic, into the analysis. But it's also very complex. I mean, when you start bringing culture in, it really does create a need to really look at a lot of different variables. But I do think that it is important if we're going to achieve the equity that we want to strive. And the other thing is what I think is the concept is really developed into a broader sense of diversity. And it's really about diversity. How do we really appreciate and effectively use diversity in a way that ends up with better outcomes and so on. So those are the reasons I think that cultural competency and this bill is important, really to help us. We were able to address in the last session cultural competency in children's services as well as in corrections. Now it's time to move into higher education, and so that's what this bill will do, is help us to reach our 40-40-20 in a very productive and effective way. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
If any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for up here, but I think those other folks probably did a good job.
They did do a good job.
Good.
Are there questions or comments for Representative Gallegos? I guess I would. I imagine you, if you haven't already, you'll have a chance to watch the discussion. One of the things that I took away from it was a need acknowledged and, in fact, identified by some of the proponents for some further amendments. And I guess I would otherwise underscore and feel free, committee members, to add to this or correct me. The committee's interest in going beyond the concept of a study and exploring what steps might need to be taken on a more immediate time frame. So with that, I think we'll be interested in your amendments and concepts about how you want to change the bill.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
There's no one else who has signed up to testify on our second go-around on 3308. Is anyone who would like to? Don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3308 and open an informational hearing on apprenticeship programs. Commissioner Avakian, thanks for being here. Please come on up. Committee, we have a number of bills and a number of discussions going on throughout the building on the concept of apprenticeships. We're particularly grateful for the commissioner to the commissioner for being here. We know that some of your staff who work on apprenticeships are not around today, so we appreciate you pinch hitting, and we're eager to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Mr. Chair, it sounds like you're almost sorry to have me here.
No.
You could have had Steve Sims, the director of our apprenticeship and training program.
Commissioner, I didn't mean that. I meant that we appreciate your flexibility and agility in stepping in.
No, I'm more than happy to be here, and I'm very pleased that you've taken up the issue of apprenticeship and in doing so, the broader issue of workforce training. And we've got it up on the board there. You've got copies of a summary that we have given you that gives you some statistics on apprenticeship and also a little bit of an explanation of what apprenticeship is. I'm not going to go through this page by page. I'm going to take just a few minutes to talk to you about what apprenticeship is, the state of it in Oregon today, and then you've got some terrific folks that actually are part of apprenticeship programs or that use apprentices and journey workers that will be up here to talk to you about it as well. One of the most effective things that we do at the Bureau of Labor and Industries in helping to prove to the world that Oregon has got the best trained and most ready workforce that you can find anywhere, and we know that that's necessary in order to grow the economy and add jobs, is to certify the state's apprenticeship training programs. Nearly all of these are devoted to the construction trades in making sure that we're providing a great workforce to build things in Oregon. If you haven't had a chance to actually take a tour through an apprenticeship program, I would encourage you to do it. If you didn't know it, the apprenticeship programs that you have supported are some of the finest that you could find anywhere on the globe. If you want to become a cement mason, a licensed electrician, a plumber, a carpenter, you really can't go anywhere and get a better education to do so than at the training programs right here in our own state. Apprenticeship is a means by which we prepare a workforce by giving them on-the-job training at the same time that they are getting classroom education to develop the skills they need to be competent and to have a great career. Apprentices can be in a program anywhere from 1 to 6 years, depending on the specific program. Generally, it's a 3 to 4 year program. During that time, they have to put in about 144 hours of classroom training for every 2,000 hours or so on the job. And apprentices make less money than a journey worker, which is what you become after you graduate from your apprenticeship. They make roughly 40 to 50% that they'll make at the end of their program. And they get to increases in that pay as their skills increase through the apprenticeship program. Now, when the economy is down, like we have seen in recent years, you also see a decrease in the number of apprenticeships that are available because there just simply is not enough work to have the apprenticeships out there, the apprentices out there doing the work. But we have seen, now that it's picked up in the last year and a half or so, we've seen an increase in the number of apprenticeships. And so we're up over 6,000 registered apprentices right now. You generally are going to see, when the economy is doing relatively well, between 6,000 and 8,000, sometimes a little bit more than that, of apprentices. And just to put a face on it for you, I wanted to tell you about an apprentice that I recently met at the ironworkers training program. I went there to meet some of them, see how they were doing, just to check on the program a little bit. And this, I asked this fellow what his story was, because he was a brand new apprentice. He had been working as a welder, and when the economy went down, he lost his job. He was laid off, which was an incredibly difficult thing, of course, for him, for his family. He didn't know where the next paycheck was going to come from. He didn't know how he was going to get food on the table for his kids. The bigger problem was he had a severely ill daughter that required medical treatment, and he didn't know how he was going to continue the medical treatment without interruption because he lost his benefits when he lost the job. He was approached by somebody from the iron worker program. He found his way into that program, was immediately put on a job that was earning him, even as an apprentice, more money than he had been earning in the job he had lost, and was on a pathway to becoming a journey worker, which would have practically doubled the amount of money that he could make for his family. And because it was part of the Iron Workers program, he was eligible for the benefit package, which included health care through the Iron Workers Union. Those are the types of stories you see when you visit one of these terrific apprenticeship programs. Apprenticeship programs can be union or non-union. They are they're always done in conjunction with industry. So you see people in the private sector, as well as the unions and the non-union facilities, all running these programs, with the Bureau of Labor and Industries just making sure that the standards are being met. I want to mention to you also the good work you did with the Supportive Services Program in the last legislative session. It's a goal to develop pathways and increase the number of women and people of color that are taking advantage of apprenticeship. And Supportive Services is a fund that you have created in order to help underwrite some of the costs that have traditionally been barriers for women and people of color. So we're talking about things like helping with the cost of daycare, with the cost of transportation, with the purchase of tools and other supplies that you might need in order to be in an apprenticeship program. You increased the amount of funding for supportive services in the last legislative session, and partly as a result of that, Oregon has more than twice now the national average of women that are finding a great career in the trades and taking advantage of apprenticeship programs. And lastly, what I wanted to mention, also a terrific thing that you have done, which we are very grateful for, is the effort on career and technical education in the middle schools and high schools. An absolute necessity to the success of apprenticeship, and I would say the same thing for the community college programs in these areas, is that you have a pipeline of folks that have found an interest and have found a pathway for themselves in a particular career. When we saw the elimination of shop class from our middle schools and high schools starting about 18 years ago in Oregon, we saw the average age of an apprentice rise from about 19 years old to over 27 years old today. Similar pattern in the community colleges, and a drastic rise in the average age of our worker in Oregon. But with the creation of the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Fund, you've been able to restore these types of programs to over 200 middle schools and high schools in Oregon. And if you refill that grant fund again this session, that number will increase dramatically. And as you'll hear, I think, from the contractors that will be coming up, this is not just good for students, it's not just good for a well-rounded public education system, but this is an absolute necessity to providing the kind of skilled workers that our homegrown Oregon businesses need in order to be successful. With that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for inviting me to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions that I could for you, but I know you've got some tremendously good folks coming up to add to the discussion.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions for the commissioner? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Commissioner Avakian, thanks for the presentation. When I think of BOLI, I think of kind of an enforcement and kind of advocacy thing for wages and working conditions and all.
Yes,
all
I know you do.
I mean, that's the proper function of BOLI. Is the apprenticeship program, when I think of apprenticeship, I think of kind of education, career technical education, kind of that kind of thing. Is it in the right home, or would it be better moved to some other agency, business development department or community colleges or something? Can you just comment on that generally?
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman. The Bureau of Labor and Industries exists in order to both protect workers and to protect industry and make sure that Oregon businesses have what they need to be successful. And frankly, the half of the agency that does civil rights and wage and hour enforcement serves both of those purposes. Oregon businesses deserve to have a level playing field when they're being in a position to have to compete against businesses that do not play by the rules, that artificially decrease their labor costs in order to get advantage in a bidding system, that are willing to discriminate against their workers, which makes it easier for them, they think, to do business. It isn't fair to the rest of Oregon businesses that do everything they can to go the extra mile and play by the rules. So even the enforcement side of what we do in support of good, successful, law-abiding Oregon businesses. But you're right, the whole other half of the agency is devoted to technical assistance for employers. We get about 20,000 calls a year from Oregon businesses looking for help navigating their way through complicated state and federal laws. We provide many of those services for free. It's a fantastic resource. And the Apprenticeship and Training Division, which exists only to supply a terrific workforce for the state. Is it in the right place? It is necessarily in the right place because everything we do at the Bureau is aimed towards helping make Oregon businesses that follow the rules be successful. Thank you.
Representative McHugh.
Chair Reed, thank you. Commissioner Vakian, it's nice to have you here. This is a very important topic to a lot of us. I just want to draw attention to one thing that you touched on very lightly and expand on it just for the record. I had an opportunity in a former position that I held to bring young rural women, high school students, on a bus up to Portland to the Women in Trades Career Fair a number of times, and to educate our high school counseling staffs and our volunteers that work with high school students that there is an incredible opportunity for their young women to understand that there's a place for them in the trades. And this is an amazing event that occurs every year. I'm just looking, it's middle school day is May 14th and high school day is Friday, May 15th, and the career day is Saturday, May 16th. And there are a whole lot of folks out there that are totally unaware that this exists. And for us to increase those numbers, this is a wonderful opportunity to get on the radar of all of our high schools and middle schools that they have a wonderful opportunity to participate in this and give young women an opportunity to see what the potential is for them to participate in the trades. And it goes unnoticed a lot of times, particularly outside of the metro area where it's expensive to get kids on a bus. But these are really important opportunities for our kids as we're emphasizing the career tech ed part of what we're trying to re-energize. This is an important component of showing young women that there's a plethora of opportunity out there for them that in a lot of areas goes unnoticed. So I just wanted to get that on the record that this is a wonderful opportunity for our young women.
That's right. Mr. Chair and Representative, as an example of that, every other year we help put on a construction trades career fair in the Lane County School District. We get over 500 students every time we do this. More than a third of them the last two times have been young women. And they get to go out and actually sit on a backhoe and dig a hole, drive a bulldozer, handle a jackhammer, operate a small crane. They get to actually do the work. And I have to tell you, the young women do it better than the young boys. And if any of you in your districts think this would be a valuable thing for the school districts that you serve, we would be more than happy to help coordinate a similar type of trades fair for your schools.
Follow up. Very important, but you know, I think once again, our rural communities are in a bit of a disadvantaged spot because it costs a lot of money to take a group of kids up to the metro area to do things like this. So, reaching out and having opportunities done in their local districts, you can cluster school districts around something like that, is a great opportunity. I encourage you all to do it. Young women don't know these opportunities are out there.
Thanks, Representative McHugh. Here, Representative Johnson, then Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. I had a chance to serve on the interim apprenticeship task force, I guess, that we created back in 2014. By the way, committee members, I did have my staff provide a copy of the task force report.
Thank you.
Which there's some really, really good information in here. It represents the summation of our work over the period of about 6 months of studying the issue. But I just want, I Along with that, I'm looking at the last slide in your presentation here that refers to the 10 years of workforce development and year-end program completions. And it shows, if this is correct, that in 2014, out of the last 10 years, that we actually had the fewest number of completions in that 10-year cycle. And I bring that up because the task force received a lot of testimony from across the spectrum, you know, rural, urban, open shop, closed shop, and so forth. But it was obvious, I think, to the committee that the pipeline, i.e. the numbers of people that we can get into the programs, is not adequate to keep up with demand. That the demand out there in the workforce has more openings than we're able to provide skilled workers for. So I'm just wondering about BOLI, if you guys might have recommendations about what could be done. You touched on CTE, obviously, but one of the other several comments we had was just the lack of geographical representation and where training programs are located, perhaps, types of trades and so forth and so on. So I'm just wondering if BOLI might have recommendations on what could be done to hopefully change this picture here, because the demand's going like this, but it seems like our completions are not keeping up with demand. So I just throw that out as kind of an open-ended question for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will shoot from the hip a little bit anecdotally with to help give you, you know, some substance of an answer, but it's a much broader discussion about where we should be heading than I can give you right here. It isn't tied just to a completion rate. And if you take a broad swipe across the whole state, you can see that there are places where, you know, folks could get to work right away. But it's different based on the geographical areas in the state as well. There's some rural parts of the state that have virtually no construction projects going on, and you don't have opportunities there. You step into the Portland market, and oftentimes you've got very large contractors with very committed workforces that are able to go in and bid on a project and take care of it because they've got a ready workforce available. And then there's other parts of the state, such as a place I just visited in Medford recently, that's lacking welders. Well, you can go to Portland and you can find yourself, a trained welder out of the iron workers facility, but you can't necessarily find one in Medford as easily. So part of it is geographically based. The biggest factor, as I see it, is that we're coming out of a period of several years here, maybe even a little longer, where we were just not building things in this state. There weren't as many public projects. There certainly were not as many private projects as there used to be. Many contractors were surviving only by bidding on some of the public projects that were available. And so you had, because of the depressed economy and the lack of projects, you had apprenticeship programs decreasing the number of apprentices that they were bringing in because they didn't even have enough jobs available in order to place their journey workers, let alone a whole crew of apprentices. The biggest key to not having this kind of herky-jerk response between the number of trained individuals and the number of immediate jobs is for, quite frankly, a massive investment by this state in both public projects and supporting private projects as well. The work certainly needs to be done. And what I can tell you is if and when that kind of an investment is made, things are being built and repaired and retrofitted again, and jobs increase. You will see the apprenticeship programs opening their doors wide to more apprentices, and you'll see the graduation rate go up as well. So I think my best explanation is we are in a period right now where things have picked up, but you've got a little bit of a lag in training programs that had to close the door to more folks for a while because there weren't jobs available in the last few years.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. Every summer, I run a small heavy equipment construction company, and every summer we open up a two-week free training with a qualification of having some experience with heavy equipment and being unemployed. We offer five slots, and it always gets pushed to a couple more slots. And our experience in the past is we create an introduction to a CDL. The class also graduates them to be a fire-carded person that could go work on wildland fires. Last year, we made a pretty big effort to include five more slots for high schools in our local district or our local area of students that had recently graduated or were over 18 years of age and had a very difficult time. We did have one student that had graduated that was able to get into the program, but where can we go for those types of programs to create interaction between the school, the graduating seniors, and have the schools comfortable from a liability standpoint to have it presented in the schools that those types of programs might be available out there. And by the way, we've had about a 70% success rate in transitioning these people from unemployment to jobs, not necessarily with our company. Three of them last year went on to get their CDL and were able to get jobs out in the industry in there. So it's been pretty successful. I know it's just a tiny drop, but what would your suggestion to engage the high school or 18-year-old seniors?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know what? The use of apprenticeship, the whole theory of apprenticeship as a workforce development system goes back thousands of years. And what you just described with your own private sector business is like the very roots of apprenticeship. It's an industry realizing what it needs in order to sustain a workforce that allows the industry to continue and to survive with skilled people. And that's why apprenticeship programs you see as joint efforts between the labor force and between business owners to give the industry what it needs. What you have created in the CTE revitalization grants is exactly the system that partners a local school district, starting at the middle school and high school, in a pathway to more training programs, to being skilled to go right in to some jobs, and to meet the needs of existing Oregon industries. One of the criteria for getting one of those grants is that the school or the district show close community partnerships that also support the program. And that doesn't mean necessarily with money. It might mean with skilled people that go out and assist a licensed teacher in the classroom. It might mean with equipment. It might mean with internships or mentorships. And so you have set up already a structure with that CTE grant fund and what you're doing with apprenticeship and community colleges that will work. So my suggestion would be anybody wanting to do that, go to your local school district or to a particular school in your district. Share with them the type of program that you think would be a good one to start and have them apply for a grant that actually makes it a reality, and then plug your local businesses into it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rudin.
I just wanted to actually follow on to that now. I changed my mind. But I think a good example of that was in the John Day area, where they had a demand for welders. And the industry and the schools got together and built a program. It's supposed to be very successful. So that is exactly the way. The comment was, I think the revitalization grants are extremely helpful, but we have to realize we're rebuilding a system that's been neglected for well over 20 years, where we have a whole generation of school teachers, administrators, counselors that don't understand apprenticeship programs or the value of skilled jobs. And so we're kind of rebuilding that. And we have a lot of work, I think, to do to help educate the educators and show them the value of an apprenticeship job and what can be done, what the options are with, college compared to, apprenticeship opportunities. So there's that sort of work that still needs to be done. And I think we're getting started.
I know, Mr. Chair, you need to get on to the other folks to testify, but if it's okay if I just wrap it up with one more comment about sure. reflective
and,
of both.
And Representative Wisdom has a question, too, so you won't get away quite yet, but please, that's fine.
I'll wait and let Representative Wisnett ask his question.
Okay. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, too. Thank you. Thanks for being here and your testimony. We had, it's related to apprenticeship, but we, looking at innovation, we've had a lot of testimony, and we had a very successful venture startup gentleman company, and I asked him, what did he see about disadvantages in Oregon for startups? And he listed land use, workforce, and taxes and regulatory policy. Would you concur with that or comment on that briefly? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I talk with literally hundreds of businesses in all four corners of the state every year, and virtually always, ask them what it is they need in order to be successful. And I have to tell you, there are two vastly predominant things that across the industry sectors, across the geography of the state, small business, huge business, that I always hear. One of them is, I don't know what regulation to expect next out of my city council, my county commission, or my state legislature. I just don't know what's coming, so it's hard to plan for the future. And the second thing is, I don't know where I'm going to get my good locally skilled workers anymore. I virtually never hear a peep about taxes. So, and it does come up occasionally, but my experience is that falls so far down into third, fourth, fifth place that it doesn't compare with the first two. And locally skilled workforce is by far the biggest concern.
We've heard that, sir. And how about land use? Do you see that as a issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is an issue. And I think we need to be doing everything we can to make sure that we are providing the kind of land that we need in order to inspire businesses to come here or to grow. How you do that, I suppose, is the real question. But that issue pales in comparison to the first two as well.
Thank you.
Representative McHugh.
Chair Reed, thank you. I participated also as vice chair of the Apprenticeship Task Force, and one of the...
It says co-chair on the...
Co-chair. Co-chair. That's correct. And one of the things, of course, from my perspective, has to do with the geographic balance. And I'm just reading the report that came out as I glanced through it. And I think it's very common knowledge that community colleges in some parts of Oregon offer opportunities for apprenticeship. And a lot of times distances to training centers is onerous for our young people who live in rural communities. And the vast majority, of course, are in the metropolitan area in the Willamette Valley. So it is a barrier for potential apprenticeships who are coming from rural communities. If they do have to travel to a metropolitan area to be trained, then it's less likely that they're going to go back to a rural community, even if those projects start to reemerge as the economy improves. And I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation about how we don't disadvantage our young adults who are, or our people who are being retrained and trying to find a different path forward that come from areas that really truly provide a geographic barrier to entry-level jobs and because they can get apprenticeship training. So it's something I want to continue to talk about, and I didn't know if you had any comment on that or not. It's an ongoing conversation. I'm not sure there are clear answers at this point in time. As the economy heats up, we hope we will find those opportunities reemerging in our rural communities, but difficult topic.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some clear answers to that. We've only got 17 community colleges, and so the community colleges, despite the really terrific efforts they put forth on workforce, just don't have the ability to touch enough human beings to fill the pipeline of workers for every Oregon industry. They are an incredibly important piece of the workforce training pie, but alone they can't do it. There are a number of apprenticeship training facilities in rural parts of the state, but again, not enough alone to meet the entire need. When we, several years ago, brought you the concept of the Career and Technical Education Grant Fund, part of the reason for that was exactly the point you're bringing up. And we studied very closely what a number of other states were doing, what Germany had done, what Japan was doing, what some of the other Asian countries were doing with regard to workforce training starting at the early ages. And we took a different path. What many states have done is they have moved these programs out of their middle schools and high schools into the community colleges, or they have set up regional training programs that you bus students to that show particular aptitudes. They test at an early age in order to see who's going to get to go to those programs and who doesn't. And it was our opinion that you cannot, again, touch enough human beings to affect your state's economy or fill a pipeline of workers in a number of different industry sectors unless you have a workforce development training presence in the four walls of middle schools and high schools in every community in the state. That's the only way to touch enough human beings to have a real effect on your state's economy. And those are the feeder programs that will go up into the other more advanced types of training programs later. You all agreed, and part of the notion behind the CTE grant fund was to be able to give grants to individual schools and districts in order to reach more students and therefore more workers as they get older and enter the workforce. So you're setting, and what I was going to say is timely now with respect to what Representatives sure. Hayden and Reardon had said earlier. The CTE grant fund alone is not the magic bullet, but it is pretty darn near close to it. If you continue investing in that grant fund and investing in the related STEM programs, so that you have a presence in every middle school and high school in the state again, and you keep your apprenticeship and community college programs strong, you will have, I think, in maybe 6 years to 8 years, because that might be how long it takes to restore all of the programs. We're a little over 200 schools now. There's a long more to go. But if you stay on this track and create that presence in every community with the pathways built upward, I can tell you, you will have created the best workforce development system that this nation has. Mm-hmm. I think you're on the right track.
Go ahead.
And Commissioner, I absolutely agree that career tech ed is critical to our redeveloping a workforce that we're going to need in the next couple of decades. And I think in this particular session, in the prior session and in this session, there is a lot of momentum behind that. And everybody agrees that that's a really critical piece. But there are parts of our rural state where those standalone apprenticeship programs that we used to have no longer exist, and the community college programs have fallen away to some extent, so those opportunities aren't there at this point in time. And I'm hopeful that we can continue to have a conversation about how we now start that pipeline with our middle school and high school, which I think we all agree is really important, but then what? And I hope we can continue that conversation. This may just be driven by the economy coming back and the pipeline opening up. But at this point in time, we do have some areas where this is a problem.
So. Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not, in my opinion, it's not going to be driven solely by the economy opening up again. We've had a strong economy at times in the last 20 years, and we have decimated our training programs because we stopped investing in them. I think this is going to take an active, strong effort on your part, on my and the Bureau of Labor and Industry's part, and on all of our partners. This is not going to happen unless we make it happen.
I hesitate to, Representative Gagas.
One very quick question. It has to do with something that I've observed, Commissioner, is that, you know, we've got the training programs in schools, high schools, community colleges, and the trades also. Is there any effort to facilitate communication or collaboration between those various silos of training so that we can really maximize resources and really try to address some of the issues you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the state has come a long, long way in just a few recent years in breaking down those silos, and you're actually seeing a very cooperative effort
between community colleges and high schools, between apprenticeship programs and high schools, in some cases now even between apprenticeship programs and community colleges, which didn't exist as much a few years ago. We're not completely there yet, but we're on the right path.
One last question from me, and then I think we do need to get to the others. You mentioned at the beginning, and I feel like I got to ask this of you, since the folks who will follow you are more directly focused on construction. You mentioned that apprenticeships generally have a pretty heavy emphasis on construction. Where else are they relevant? Where else are they growing?
Mr. Chair, committee members, you could build an apprenticeship program for virtually any industry sector that you want. They have historically been in the building and construction trades. We've seen a smattering of it in healthcare and law enforcement, but it is predominantly there. We've even had, we've had groups come to us to expand it in healthcare in the last few years, but it's a momentous thing to start apprenticeship, and it hasn't happened on a wide scale. We even had the Astoria Explorer Post, part of the Boy Scouts of America, come to us and say, we'd like our Explorer Post to be a certified apprenticeship program for the maritime industry. Mm-hmm. And in the end, they weren't able to put together, everything they needed in order to make that happen. But I think they're still thinking about it, and we are completely ready to certify a program like that if they can get it put together. I'd love to see a vast expansion in industry sectors that have a presence in apprenticeship.
Interesting. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here and
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Conversation started. Thank you. So we have four people signed up here, and I guess we should start with John Mollis. While you're coming up, Mr. Mollis, I just want to make the announcement so that you don't get the wrong impression. I have to go next door at some moment here for some amendments on a different bill. When I leave, it's not anything you said. I'll turn the gavel over to the vice chair and be back as soon as I can. Mr. Mollis, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is John Mollis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I am a journeyman bricklayer and stonemason by trade. I had the good fortune to start a union apprenticeship 37 years ago this month. The paperwork that the administrator is sharing with you right now is a copy of a letter from the minute book of the union I belong to, which is Bricklayers Local 1, based in Portland. And the recording secretary back in the 1880s, when they wrote a letter, didn't go down and run it through the copy machine to keep a copy for themselves and their records. They wrote a copy of it in the minute book. And this is a copy of a letter that went to a young man in 1888 on how to make application to the Bricklayers Union to become an apprentice. And so we've been doing this in Oregon for a long, long time. We spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing it. And in cooperation with our signatory contractors, we feel that we turn out the best trained workforce in the United States. And we meet with companies that are looking to site projects in Oregon, and we frequently take them through tours of our training facilities. And I can look any of them in the eye and tell them, if you want to build your project in Oregon, we can provide you with the safest, most productive, most quality-oriented workforce any place in the United States of America, right here in Oregon. And we take a lot of pride in that. Apprenticeship is a great opportunity to learn a craft or skill, as the commissioner said earlier. In fact, we like to call apprenticeship the original four-year degree. Not everybody's going to college, and that's okay. And this is a good, viable alternative for young people that aren't going to do that. Different crafts have different minimum qualifications and are open at different times of the year to take apprentices. So whenever I talk to a young person that's interested, I urge them to either go to our state council's website and click on the link on how to become an apprentice. And that has a listing of all our programs and the minimum standards and when they're open and taking applications, or to go to the Boley website, and that lists all programs, union and non-union. Earn while you learn, as the commissioner said earlier, 90% of an apprentice's learning comes on the job, working with journey level workers, sharing their crafts, and there's a minimum of 144 hours per year of related training that's in the classroom that's in addition to that. Most of them are 2 to 5 year programs, and when I say and in all honesty, most of them are 3 to 5. And when I say 3 to 5, then that means there's 6,000 to 10,000 hour apprenticeship programs. So it might take more than 6,000 hours to get through a 3-year program, especially in the last few years when work has been slow. And every 1,000 hours, as you have those 1,000 hours of on-the-job related training, as long as you have completed all your required classroom training and you have positive progress reports from your employer, then you receive a raise, and you keep getting raises every 1,000 hours or approximately 6 months until you journey out. And I always enjoy talking to parents that are thinking about this and telling them if your son or daughter comes into one of our programs and makes the commitment to go through that 3 to 5 year program and receive that training, at the end of that time, we'll turn them out at journey level. They'll be earning wages that equate to about $50,000 to $80,000 a year. And in addition to that, they'll have full family health and welfare coverage. They'll have a defined benefit pension program, usually a supplemental defined contribution program. And their student loans at the end of that program will be zero. And we take a lot of pride in that. Over the last 20 years, we've worked really close with pre-apprenticeship providers such as Oregon Tradeswomen, which Representative McEwen referenced earlier, Portland Youth Builders, Constructing Hope. And these entities were formed to try and prep people up and get them ready for apprenticeship opportunities in non-traditional careers, in places where they've been historically underrepresented. And so all of our programs have worked very hard with them over the last 20 years, and the construction workforce looks a lot different than it did many years ago when I started. In fact, it looks dramatically different than it did 20 years ago. There's a couple of things related to this that I think I should mention that are really important to the success of apprenticeship programs. And Commissioner Avakian and several of you already spent a lot of time on bringing CTE classes back into our schools and education system, and I think that's dramatically important. There's just far too many, not only students, but counselors and teachers and principals and school board members that really have no idea about opportunities in the trades and how those work. And so I think it's really important that we fund those. And then the second thing is...
Interrupt for just a second. Excuse me. Representative McEwen has a question.
Mr. Mullis, you just opened a door, and I cannot resist jumping through it. I spent a number of years working with high school staff and volunteers who work in high schools to help students with their post-secondary planning. And almost to a high school counselor, I found that when they come out of their master's programs and walk into high schools to take over a counseling office, they understand college access, but they are not trained on opportunities beyond community colleges and four-year colleges. And I, over and over again, I had to go in and train high school counseling staff on opportunities for apprenticeship. And it's a missing piece in how we train people who work in high schools. And I'm sorry, I just want to get it on the record that this is something that you know, OSAC works at in a very narrow focus, but as a state, we do not do a good job of that. And so I just wanted to note that as you're passing by that very interesting topic. So thank you for indulging me.
Your passion is evident,
yes.
Which is good.
Mr. Chair, it's like we have the Aspire program, but we don't have a program to help people learn hardworking jobs and trades.
It's limited.
Yeah.
Thanks. Aspire, you're fine. If you don't, you're not. So.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Well,
there
please
you go.
Continue. Chair Reed and
for what it's worth.
McEwen, I couldn't agree more. And we've found it very frustrating over the last 20 years that we'll be approached by a high school counselor that says, I've got this student that's really struggling, and they're probably never really going to make it at anything, and can you make a construction worker out of them? And it's, in all honesty, really pretty insulting because unless you really take the time to understand how the high skill level that's required in these jobs, very high math skills, very high, hand and eye and motor skills and putting things together, working with other crafts, communication skills, safety. We want the best of the best. to apply to our programs. And going back to a question that Representative Johnson asked earlier about the number of applicants, we found, on an ongoing basis through good times and bad, is we have far more applicants to all of our programs than we can take in. And I think part of that goes back to the good wages and benefits and pension programs that we offer. And that's a good thing. We like to have lots of applicants so we can take the best of the best. But you're exactly right, Representative McCune. It's very frustrating to us. One of the things that some of our apprenticeship programs have been trying to do is they've been inviting in teachers and counselors and school board members into their training centers to show them what we actually do. And I think once they get in there and see the investment that we have in those programs and the difficulty of the courses and the high level of education that we provide, they start to understand it. But it's a long and ongoing process.
Thank you. And it's also, I think, contingent upon us to make sure that our high school students understand that if they do want to go into the trades, that they do need to have a robust math curriculum in high school. They need to be able to write and speak at a level that puts them in good stead with being a professional, in essence, being as someone who has a job that requires that level of skill as they go into it. And a lot of students, as you mentioned, think this is a default. It's not. They have to prepare to go into these programs, and it's not understood widely in our K-12 system. So, thanks. And now I'll stop.
Representative Rudin? Well, just applaud a little bit of work done by some of the union folk. We had an industry day last spring, and a lot of school folks were invited in. Some. And quite a few showed up, but there's room for more, and we need to continue that kind of an effort. I think it's really opening eyes. Once they get down to the Trade Center and they see it, it's like, wow.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, thanks for being here and sharing your testimony. I want to go back to a comment you made earlier about I perceive it to be a disconnect between the number of applicants and the number of openings. Okay, more applicants, not enough openings. And it gets me back to, again, the question or exchange between Rep. Wisnett and Commissioner Avakian in that what he hears from folks is about the lack of trained folks locally can be a deterrent to job location in Oregon. And it gets me kind of to a chicken or egg situation. You know, as a state, we have to look at this. What comes first, the demand for the work or the well-trained workforce? Having the well-trained workforce can be an inducement to bring those jobs here. But the problem that we found and that we learned in the task force, and obviously you participated in that too, is that we can't just snap our fingers and have a well-trained workforce. We're talking about a period of time, years, to go through a program. And one of the things I've never quite understood well is just the program's very prescriptive formula for allowing only certain numbers of individuals through, because it seems to me, and again, I'm just talking from my perspective here, but if we had a greater volume of highly trained folks out there who may not be employed immediately, but at least they're there, it would serve as an inducement to other businesses to come to Oregon. But I say that for the other reason is that in this committee, higher ed, we know statistics are clear that any amount of post-secondary training, education, certification, however you want to quantify it for an individual, is going to be beneficial to them. The statistics are clear that their work, their earning potential, and just their potential to be a good human goes up exponentially. So again, I've never quite understood the training program's reticence to open up this pipeline, get as many people trained as we can, and then we know that the work will come because we have that workforce in Oregon. So I'll just throw that out there and let you chew on it as you may.
Thank you.
Well, and Chair Reed and Representative Johnson, I can't speak to the need for, you know, a trained workforce for factories or for facilities that are going to build and locate in Burns or John Day or Madras or Coos Bay or the outlying areas. But from a construction perspective, it's really difficult to try and thread the needle between how many apprentices do you start in any given year and to factor in for how many people are going to retire and what's the work outlook going to be in the future. And we always try and find that fine line between, you know, having not too many and not enough, because neither one of those are successful. I mean, when the work is jumping like it is in Portland right now, all of a sudden the demand is great, and so all of a sudden our programs are ramping up big time. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, we were experiencing unemployment rates of 35 to 60%, depending on you know what part of the state you were in and what craft. And since 90% of an apprentice's learning is on the job, there has to be jobs in order to be a successful apprentice. It costs us probably $8,000 to $10,000 a year to train an apprentice, and those are all funds that are in our world are generated by industry funds from our collective bargaining agreements. And so what we don't want to do is start an apprentice and train them for a year or two, and they're working about half time, and they finally figure out, you know, this isn't working for me. I need a steady paycheck. I'm gonna quit this and go someplace else. So we've just invested a pretty good amount of money in somebody, and they've left us. So we want to make sure that when we start an apprentice, they have a reasonable expectation and a reasonable chance of working steady in their industry. And that, we feel, is good for the apprentice, it's good for the employer, it's good for the industry. And it's imperfect, trust me, but we do our very best to try and make sure that that pipeline is not too hot and not too cold, but try and get it just right. It's hard to do, trust me.
We'll have to start calling you Goldilocks. That's very good. Do you have one more closing remark?
That, yes, please. And the second thing that I think can greatly affect apprenticeship, and the first being CTE, which has already been discussed. But the second is jobs, and it goes right back to the conversation we were just having. In order for an apprentice to not only get started, they have to have a job, but to continue to progress and journey out, they have to have work. There has to be jobs. And so, I would argue that the best thing you could do to support apprenticeship programs is to fund projects around the state. I mean, there are roads and bridges and water systems and schools in every county and every city and every corner of this state that need to be rebuilt and built. And those aren't just jobs in Portland. They're jobs every place. And so that's really what we need. The more work that's out there and the more work that's coming, the more opportunity we're going to have to start apprentices, and the more journey-level workers we're going to be able to turn out at the end of the day.
Thank you very much.
So I would thank you for the invitation to be here. I would do my best to answer any questions.
Great. I think we've been rudely interrupting you throughout with our questions. Unless there are any last ones, we'll send you on your way.
Right.
Thanks for bringing
the
letter, too. It really highlights how bad my handwriting is.
Maybe I think that's good.
This is good. Mine is bad.
And this was in support of John Mullis getting his apprenticeship?
I don't think this was referring to Mr. Mullis. I think it was somebody else.
1888.
So next on our list, John Rakowitz, Tom Girding, and Larry Gesher, please. Thank you for coming, gentlemen. Please
Thank
go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Chair Reed, members of the committee, first, John Rakowitz, for the record, I'd like to make sure, how much time do we have? Because we've tried to do some preparation yesterday when this hearing focus changed,
yep.
And I want to make sure that we
need to be out of here by 10, and
okay.
there's probably a minute or two of the sort of close-up stuff.
Okay.
Again, I may have to depart briefly in the middle of that, but that's it for us.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. We're the largest and the most diverse commercial contractors association in the state of Oregon. We have contractors of every stripe. So we always look at these things from an industry perspective. And as I mentioned, and we have two people who are going to give you some real on-the-ground industry perspectives, two different types of contractors doing different types of work to try to ground this discussion. What we had been preparing for until yesterday was the issue of apprenticeship mandates on contractors to hire a particular number. And so a lot of our testimony is going to be anchored around that issue. I want to start first with, I have not handed in written testimony today, and I have went back, I put it in the file. I have testimony dating back to 08. It is a very thick file. This has been the issue of a mandate for public works on contractors has been hotly debated and is, I believe, a big part of the stimulus for this hearing today. So I just wanted to put out there that's going to be most of our focus today, because we see this as a great opportunity. And fussing and fighting is probably a mild way to put it. Since I came on, we've just been battling each other. I want to take this opportunity first to talk about what's been going on quietly underneath that discussion, and that is the issue. And there are members of this committee and many members in this building that support it and have supported for many years, and that's the issue of revitalizing career tech education. It is so fundamental to our industry, and I don't care if you're talking about the labor side or the management side. It is fundamental. And there's been a lot of discussion about it today. I would like to, the good news is here's where we stand. A few years ago, Labor Commissioner Avakian was right in the forefront of it. Since then, we have had leaders of both parties, both chambers, including members of this committee, who have been leading the way on this issue. It is so fundamental that I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk about it. So the good news is that the same people battling out on this other issue have all agreed on one thing, and that is if you do not revitalize career tech education in a substantial and permanent way and fund it, and I believe this is the session that we can turn that corner and begin to make a down payment on a system that really will produce enough apprentices that we could meet a mandate. If you don't do that, we're just going to be, our kids are completely disadvantaged. So a few years ago, we managed to get $2 million in grants. We're now up to $11, $12 million in grants in the biennium. That's the good news. It's no accident that both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget has substantial numbers upping the ante on what this state invests in career tech ed. We're very pleased about it, and I think anybody associated with an apprenticeship discussion would say that is the first thing that you have to do before you can do anything else. Here's the bad news. You look to our neighbor north. They invest, state of Washington invests $380 million a year in career tech education. So whose kids are going to be ready to come into our apprenticeship programs? Their kids. They're beating us. So we have to make a down payment. That's my plea. I think there's some very serious discussions going on upping that number in a very serious way, and I hope every member of this committee will support that. Why does it matter so much just strictly from an industry point of view? Well, the Employment Department tells us right now that by 2020, which is not very far away, a couple of more legislative sessions, we're going to need 25,000 new workers to meet our industry's workforce demands. Why? Because we face the same demographic challenge that every other industry in the whole country faces. First of all, we're going to lose 10,000 workers to retirement. Average age right now, 55 years of age. They're going to retire. In addition to that, if you just have an economy that sort of works, sort of like now, you're still going to have to replace and grow those new workers that, to meet that demand. So when you look at that, we have no choice. We are all in on apprenticeship workforce development. As an industry, we will live or die on that. So I think it's really important for people to note, AGC, for instance, has been working on this issue outside of what goes on in this building for many, many years. Every year we do a budget. We don't have a giant budget as an association. 15-20% of our funds go directly to pay for programs like ACE. Many of you probably know about ACE Academy. It's a great example of four East Multnomah County high schools, students from there attending the ACE Academy, architecture, construction, engineering. We just in December did something that's a national first. AGC, in partnership with ACE, opened the first high school chapter, so that those kids will have direct contact, they will have a leg up, they will be meeting with contractors and understand the industry in a way that nobody else will. Those are the kind of programs we have to expand all over the state. And right now, we just can't do it. I'm going to pass out at the end some baseball cards, and I'm not going to do it now because I think we'll lose your attention because they're such a nice thing. But if you remember the old baseball cards, well, you're going to see carpenters and welders and iron workers, and you're going to see how much it what they get paid. One of them, you know, do you like to play with fire a little bit? And then that's the welder. That's how you pull a kid in, right, at 16 years of age. Take a look at those. Look at the wages and know that those are the average wages. In the state of Oregon, last year, the average wage of a construction worker was $52,000 a year. That's the average. We work on the high end of that, way higher than that. Why? Because we do the bigger, more complicated work, so you hire the more skilled labor. So people make a very living wage in this. But if, and it's been discussed by any number of members of this committee, we don't have the system to supply right now. We don't have the programs. And that's why we think it's so critical to return every time to that investment in career tech ed. With that, I just want to hand it over to Larry Gesher. He's our board president this year. And he can give you a perspective as a highway contractor, what it's like to actually try to make apprenticeship work on an actual job, and how difficult and complex that can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chairs, Representatives. As John stated, my name is Larry Gesher. I'm the president of HP Civil. We're located in Staten, Oregon. We are an emerging small business, heavy highway contractor, mainly specializing in bridge construction. We've been in business just over a year. We started a year ago, March 1st, actually. I am this year's president of the Association of General Contractors, the Oregon Columbia chapter. And today I just want to share a little bit of my experience as far as working with ODOT over the course of the last really 8 years, trying to get an apprenticeship program together that could be successful, and a little bit about how that program of mandating an apprenticeship goal on public works, how it affects us. And so we started in about, it must have been about 2005. We had the OTIA 3 money that was hitting the state. A lot of focus was on ODOT because there was a huge amount of work hitting ODOT to put all these 185 bridges in place in a matter of a 3 to 4 year period. And so initially ODOT went down the path and put together a specification, a requirement to require 10% apprenticeship on all their projects, and they were craft specific. The contractors, we didn't get input into it. It was put out into contracts, and we began to try and implement. We had told them it wouldn't work because we needed the flexibility in our jobs to be able to take our crews and work crews. A lot of times with the subcontractors, we end up a lot of smaller crews, and so it's really difficult to have a assigning subcontractor show up on a job for the first 2 days of the job to install signs, and they may have three people out there. They may have an operator and a laborer, or maybe two laborers. Sometimes it's two, sometimes it's three, and to say, okay, now you have to put 10% apprenticeship on those 2 days of work. And so it really becomes a struggle. And as the first jobs kind of went through the hopper, they began to see that we weren't achieving 10%. At the time, there was no means to do anything as far as coming down the contractors, other than to more or less come back and say that the contractor was in breach of contract. And Matt Garrett at the time, when we sat in the meetings and talked, he said, that's not going to do me any good because I won't have any contractors to come and, you know, bid my work, because everybody will be in breach of contract based on apprenticeship goals. And so we went to the table and started working through a process to figure out how we could make apprenticeship work. It took a lot of time and a lot of iterations to get there. And we landed on a provision or a specification that is 10% across the board, but it's craft neutral. And initially, a lot of the trades were concerned about their trade was going to get left out because we'd concentrate more on carpenters building bridges or more on operators building roads. And the numbers show it's not the case. We're achieving 10% across the board in almost every craft out there. And that's just basically, through the process, it's dumped onto the general contractor to figure out how to get 10% across your project. And so we may have 50 subcontractors on a bigger job, and it's up to us to figure out how we're going to get there. Initially, what we saw when apprenticeship first hit ODOT is we had people quoting projects excluding apprenticeship participation in their quotes. And you'd call them up and say, well, no, you know, we need apprenticeship. Well, then it'd be, well, I've got to add money, or I can't do it because I'm not certified. We don't have anybody in the area. And so that became a real struggle, because obviously we try to hire locally with our subcontractors, because typically they're our best price. And obviously we're trying to be competitive so we can be a low bid. And so going through that process, getting it to where it's craft neutral, the other piece of it is, we ended up on an incentive discount program with ODOT. And so I know there were several representative senators that came into our meetings, and they were concerned that they were paying us to do apprenticeship. Yes, apprenticeship costs money. They're our labor force. And so ODOT's provision of paying $20 per hour is not extra on top of our labor force. That's part of our workforce. It's how we bid our work. So the ODOT program, the way it works is there's a provision in our contract. They equate the hours on the job to, they try to hit 10%. Sometimes they're over, sometimes they're under. They're trying, you know, they've done a pretty good job of getting it refined pretty close. And so say there's 1,000 hours of apprenticeship listed in our contract. It's listed in there at $20 per hour. We can't hire an apprentice for $20 per hour. And so that's just a piece of the cost of the apprenticeship. But what that is, it's the incentive disincentive piece. And so as we go through the project, for every apprenticeship hour that we achieve, we get paid $20. If we go through that project and we hit 1,000 hours, we collect the $20,000 that goes to paying that those apprenticeship hours that we had. They'll pay us up to 150% of that amount, because obviously they want to incentivize us to do more. But the downside is, if you don't achieve 1,000 hours, say you achieve 750 hours, they take all that money back that they've paid you for the 750 hours. They take all that money back, plus they penalize you the delta between the goal and where you were. So that's a disincentive piece. And so needless to say, we're achieving 10% across the board. And so I guess the biggest thing I want you guys to hear out of this is we're all for apprenticeship as contractors. We grow our workforce with or without a hard goal criteria, because we have to have people to build our work. Initially, when ODOT had the OTIA 3 money hitting the street, they were concerned that the contractors in the state couldn't handle the amount of work. They did all kinds of outreach trying to go outside the states to draw their contractors in. At the end of the day, Oregon contractors deliver the job ahead of schedule and on budget. That's what we do. We build things, we react, and so that's our goal in life, is to build jobs. Another piece that goes along with the apprenticeship is there's often, which I kind of call social engineering myself, but before I started my business in March, I was a project manager on the Selwood Bridge in Portland for 3 prior years. Multnomah County decided they wanted to target 20% apprenticeship, and within the workforce they wanted 20% minority and 20% female participation. That makes up 60% of the workforce on the job that are hired because they're in training, because of their race or their gender, not because of their qualifications. So that leaves 40% of your workforce as your qualified people that you're out trying to find the best people you can that are trained already in that position.
Excuse me. Is that the same project that you were criticized for going slightly over budget on?
Yes.
Thank you.
And it was in the paper yesterday. But those other things, I mean, so apprenticeship is one piece of the puzzle of our workforce. Because there's other criteria out there, you know, that we have to achieve for affirmative action, equal opportunity employment things. And so we just got to be cognizant of, when we start putting hard goals on things, how it trickles down and affects the whole gamut of what jobs cost to build. And I think with that, I just wanted to give a brief explanation. Tom will go into more detail. I want to leave a little bit of time at the end for questions, too. So with that, I'd like to turn over to Tom.
Okay. So my name's Tom Girding. I'm owner of T. Girding Construction and Girding Builders, down based out of Corvallis. And we are a medium-sized general contractor on the building side. We go vertical on our buildings. I am a AGC board member and past AGC president, and also was an active member on the apprenticeship task force that's been referenced earlier. With that, I would certainly like to acknowledge and appreciate Co-Chair Representative McCune and Representative Johnson for serving on that and in your time and energy put forth on that.
Thank you.
Apprenticeship is a very complicated issue, and when one begins to dive into the varying details of it in its current state, you just realize how complicated it is, and I think for that reason out of it came this task force to tackle the many issues with it. The task force was a broad mix of public owners and both labor and industry representatives within the trade there. We had cross-section of both union and open shop as well, so a very broad mix on this. And at the start of the task force, one of the first things we came to agreement on is that any recommendation coming out of the task force, we would look for a consensus on that. And I think that was modeled out of the successful CMGC task force that was created several years ago. And I served on that committee, and we spent 2 years with a very similar mix of members on the task force and wrestled through a lot of tough issues. But in the end, we did come to a consensus and ultimately a bill that was passed in the 2013 session. So it was with that end that we looked at it and said, let's come out of this with a consensus on whatever recommendation. Out of that task force, there were really two items, I think, that we had consensus on. One was vigorously supporting CTE. We've heard tons of that this morning, and the task force clearly understood that piece. And I think the other one was ultimately to continue the work of the task force, recognizing there was a lot of work yet to be finished. With all due respect, Representative McEwen and Representative Johnson, do we think we've completed the work and we're ready for a apprenticeship bill? And with that, you know, are we ready to mandate things like all contractors must hire 10% apprenticeship on all projects, on all trades, regardless of availability of such apprentices? I know we're not testifying on a specific bill today, but ensuring I'm providing some form of useful information, I am using the 10% mandate as it has been discussed as possible requirement of a bill or bills that still may come before you. With this in mind, I'd like to run a likely scenario on a recent project that my firm has completed. We were recently awarded several CMGC contracts in Lincoln County. They had a large bond issue pass several years ago. One of the projects
Sorry, Tom, could you do, just for the people who are listening who may not be in the room, explain what CMGC is, just to clarify?
Sure. So
thank you so much.
You bet. My apologies. So CMGC stands for Construction Managers General Contracting, and that is a mechanism that the state has put into place for some years to allow public entities to negotiate the award of a contract, where they're not looking at just low bid, but they're looking at best value. They're looking at the cross-section of price, as well as qualifications, approach to the project, key personnel, and a variety of things such as that.
Thank you.
Thank you. So one of the projects was the new Walport High School, and their budget was tight, yet they had all the needed requirements of a whole new high school. As the contractor, we had the task of providing them all the needed classrooms, shop areas, gymnasiums, locker room, administrative offices, athletic facilities, parking lots, the whole gamut, against a fixed dollar amount. And our job as the contractor was to deliver that with the available funds of roughly $14 million. And as with any bond levy, they had no additional funds available. They had to do this project within that set amount of money. In addition, it was their hope and wish for this project to provide local economic stimulus to the constituents within the Lincoln County, who, by the way, were funding the project. Hiring local labor and contracting with local subcontractors and suppliers was a desire of theirs as much as possible. Obviously, there's the laws and all those things within CMGC. I can share with you that with a tremendous amount of effort and outreach, we were successful in achieving their needs. I can also share with you that if we had applied a 10% requirement, the majority of local contractors would not have been able to comply and would have been barred from competing for the work. Additionally, such a requirement would have reduced the available pool of subcontractors, limiting many subcontractor trades to the larger metro regions. In the end, it would have eliminated many smaller local firms that hire local employees and instead have been forced to subcontract to larger metro area firms. This would have resulted in higher cost due to obviously the travel and per diem cost and all paying to the workers to commute to a remote location, as well as the loss of local employment. Please note, I am not anti-apprenticeship. Quite the contrary. As Larry had noted, we live and breathe by apprenticeship, by growing our workforce. I am constantly promoting it within our area high schools. Every time I have an opportunity to talk to any public official or teachers or young people, promoting the wonderful opportunity that the trades provide. In addition, within my firm, we have about 18 project superintendents who are the guys and gals that run the projects and make it happen on site.
Mr. Girding, we only have a few minutes left.
Yes.
And if you want to maybe wrap up and see if we have a question.
Okay. So we're all for apprenticeship. In closing, I've based my scenario on one possible item, the mandated percentages. The reality is I could have provided you a dozen scenarios on a dozen other potential things that come into it. Just as CMGC was a very complex issue with a broad mix of membership that wrestled with many of the issues, views, and desires, thoughts, and ideas, after the 2 years, we did come to a consensus with a bill. I guess I would ask to please push this back to the task force and ask them to complete the work that they started, similar to the CMGC, so that the industry and public owners can reach consensus and ultimately come to a bill that would have widespread support from the industry as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there any quick question for the panel before we...
Mr. Chair, could we... the numbers were unbelievable that you had to have, apprentice and minority and sex. What were those numbers again? But that was strictly for the Milwaukee project.
That was
right?
That was the Selwood Bridge project,
which was city overlay. But what is the state requirements?
State, they have 10% apprenticeship.
It
varies by region on with regards to minority and female. It depends on, obviously, they look at the demographic.
Thank you.
I'm talking off the cuff. I think it's 14% minority, 7% women. Is their target.
But the Milwaukee project was 60% requirement.
Yes.
And can I have a clarification, too, Mr. Chair? You agreed the industry agreed on the 10% for apprenticeship across the board, not each.
Yes.
Not each. And
yes.
And that's workable?
Yes.
Thank you.
At the time, that was workable with ODOT, and now we're talking a lot bigger pie here. Well, and that's going to be the concern is now we go statewide with all public works. The pool has to be a lot bigger to fulfill that need. We are fulfilling a very unique niche with ODOT in that criteria.
And again, for the people, like the representative said, watching, industry wants apprentice because it's less pay, but you got to worry about safety and supervision, right?
Mm-hmm. Quality.
Thank you very much, and it sounds like the task force did a great job, but it looks like there might be a little bit more to do.
Definitely.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So we'll close the session, hearing session. Thank you.
Thank you.